Library. I'm Carolyn Waters, the head librarian. And I thank you all for coming tonight. This is the 20th anniversary of the New York City Book Awards, which is, you know, it seems like a fairly significant period of time until you consider the fact that the library itself just celebrated its 262nd anniversary. The New York Society Library was founded in 1754 in the belief that the availability of books would help the city to prosper. What better institution than to honor books of literary quality or historical importance that evoke the spirit or enhance appreciation of this amazing city that we live in. The awards were first conceived in 1994 by Mark Peel, at the time the library's head librarian, and shepherded it into existence by Henry S.F. Cooper Jr., trustee, who wrote, "As in the case of all great ideas, it's hard to believe nobody thought of it before." Kenneth T. Jackson's The Encyclopedia of New York City was awarded the first prize by an inaugural jury chaired by Christopher Gray, and which also included Jacques Barzun, Joan K. Davidson, who I believe is in the room today, Alfred Kazin, Elizabeth Barlow Rogers, and Wendy Wasserstein. I have had the pleasure of sitting in silently in this year's jury committee meetings, and I can tell you that the work they do is really extraordinary. Reading and evaluating nearly 120 books over the course of many, many months, the jury's discussions were thoughtful, informed, and very passionate. And throughout, the jury was guided by the patient, steady, and skillful presence of Lucienne Block. Please join me in welcoming Lucienne, chair of the New York City Book Awards jury.
I would like to take this opportunity Laura Wexler will fill that seat, and to wish him as good a time as I had with and on the job. A longtime member of the library board.
Thank you so much, Lucianne. As Lucianne said, I'm happily a longtime trustee of this library, member of the Authors Guild, and a longtime supporter, I guess it's been about now 6 years, of the New York City Book Awards. Each May at this event, I stand here and talk about what draws me to this special place. And the significance in my eyes of celebrating books. I've spoken about the gutting of the publishing industry, the difficulty of a writing career for even the most distinguished author, and my respect for those who persevere to create original, important, uplifting works chosen as jury prize winners. In the past, I invoked the memory of my mother, who sent me to this library as a teenager to take out books that I couldn't find at school, and my bibliophile friend Peter Berry, a classic scholar and library aficionado who felt especially at home here. Today, I'd like to simply dwell on the notion of gratitude. How lucky are we to have such a fine library with 300,000 books on offer, not just a lending operation, but a community for readers and for writers and a cultural resource for this neighborhood and for the city at large. How lucky are we to be able to enjoy the luxury of reading in a world where books, for the most part, are not found in households and where global illiteracy hovers around 20% for men and 20% for women. How lucky are we, a small, energetic band with education, leisure, and an inclination to vet authors while simultaneously marking the many facets of our city. At a time when the future of libraries is unclear, we can take comfort in the 2.5-century history of this institution and its commitment to relevance and to meeting the needs of members in the decades ahead. The jury awards exemplify how this library recognizes what is new and what is worthy. I myself am grateful to have the chance to lend a hand in enabling these meaningful awards. Thank you so much.
Explores Coney Island as the precursor of modern mass culture entertainment. Coney Island, the melting pot, simmering with diverse nationalities, ethnic groups, social classes, and others. One writer called it a national monument and said it was virtually un-American not to have seen it. Coney Island, the place of glitter and illusion, sordid activities, freaks and sideshows, and of course, financial speculation. The name Trump is involved. Amazing also for me, particularly to find out the connection between Coney Island and cinema. They were born in the same year, 1895, the year that the motion picture projector and the portable film camera were developed, is the same year that Coney Island opened. And just as soon as they were developed, a film crew immediately raced out to Coney Island to film its new attraction, the Action Ride, which was called Shoot the Shoot. And that is S-H-O-O-T, and then C-H-U-T. And what it was boats appearing to cascade over a waterfall and carrying adventure seekers in it. But it was really affixed to a track under the water. And in other words, the motion picture was capturing fun in motion, really an illusion of an illusion. Coney Island, Visions of the American Dreamland is a book that manages to capture in its pages the city of fun, as the amusement park was often called. And the book itself is an awful lot of fun, too. So please, Robin, come up and receive the award. For that extraordinarily perceptive and sensitive introduction. I am so thrilled and honored to accept this award from the illustrious New York Library Society. And I want to thank, in addition to all of you and everyone who was on the panel that judged these awards, I want to thank my talented colleagues at the Wadsworth Atheneum Museum of Art in Hartford, Connecticut, and at the Yale University Press, who worked tirelessly to bring this book to life. Some of them are in the audience right now: Catherine Bowler of the Press, Jenny Chan of Jack Design, and my curatorial colleague, Erin Monroe, as well as our new director, Tom Lohman. If you haven't been to Hartford, you need to go. And even if you've never set foot on the beach at Coney Island, this is a book that you can read from cover to cover. And that is clearly true because it is a publication that accompanies a major traveling exhibition that opened in Hartford, then went to San Diego, then to Brooklyn, where of course they understand that Coney Island is a strip center in Brooklyn. But then from there, it is now going to open at the McKay Art Museum in San Antonio, Texas. And the fact that visitors from all of those places were able to relate to the exceptional objects, very diverse objects in this exhibition, proves what artists, filmmakers, writers, musicians have always known, which is that Coney Island is not just a strip of sand in Brooklyn, it is a seminal place in the American imagination and always will be. Working on this project was a labor of love because, yes, it's true, I am a Brooklyn girl. And I have walked on that boardwalk and done other things there, as did my grandparents and my parents before them, and millions of people. Coney Island is about people. It has a gritty, democratic spirit that's like no other place in the world. So artists have used it as a vehicle to, as Ella was pointing out, imagine the future when it was the world's greatest playground, the greatest mechanical amusement park in the world, and later as a place to recall the past. They have also, of course, their images as you flip through this book are about changing ideas of leisure and about sort of social, technological, and all kinds of experimentation, let's put it that way. In addition, and most importantly, perhaps, New York City's sandy backyard is a place where people from different classes,
backgrounds, races, ethnicities, different sexual desires can meet people who would never necessarily meet in a place like this or on the streets of New York City. They meet skin to skin, transcending social boundaries. And because of that, these images, as you look through the book, I hope will take you on a journey, because these artists looked at Coney Island as a prism through which to view the American experience. And that's really what it's about, these tableaus of wonder and menace, dreams and nightmares, are, as Ferlinghetti recognized, metaphors for the collective soul of our nation. And I hope that readers who get lost in this book will, through artists' eyes, think about the future of Coney Island and of places like that, that really are so essential to understanding who we are as a people. Thank you so much for this recognition. I thank you from the bottom of my heart on behalf of the Wadsworth Athenaeum and Yale Press.
Haswell was a distinguished New Yorker who had been, among other things, a trustee of the Brooklyn Bridge and head of the New York City Council, and his book covered the four decades or so leading up to the Civil War. Hamilton turns up in 1853. The Third Avenue streetcar line began operations that year. The New York Society Library was moving from Broadway to University Place, and the country's first World's Fair opened at Bryant Park. Each of these gets a sentence or two. Hamilton gets a page and a half. Haswell calls him a well-known and notorious character who, before he got to Wall Street, had been engaged in a venture to pass off a large amount of counterfeit coin and had been indicted for insurance fraud. But the real problem was Hamilton was a black man. Haswell says, a dark mulatto, almost of the Sambo shade. And I'm actually leaving out the offensive language. And he just didn't know his place. It had been 43 years, and Haswell was still seething. In consequence of the brazen manner in which he assumed the privileges of a white man, aided by the passive submission of a majority of those he met, he rode in street stages, ostentatiously exhibited himself at lunch in the lunch counter at Delmonico's, and addressed or referred to some acquaintances, white ones, obviously, in a familiar manner. Haswell then describes a racially charged encounter which he enjoyed from across the street, between Hamilton and a well-known gentleman of this city who, as Haswell tells it, needed just a few well-chosen words to put this upstart in his place. I was fascinated by this glimpse of a personality who could stir such rancor even decades later, but I never found a trace of him in any published work. Now, happily, Shane White has taken up the trail. He spent hundreds of hours reading long runs of the full gamut of New York City newspapers, not just the better known and nicely indexed ones that all scholars go to, but all the papers you could find. Even better, he dived into an essentially new, or at least untapped, information source, the court reports, indictment papers, and other legal records in the municipal archives and county clerk's office. And the result is this wonderful book. Prince of Darkness. Prince of Darkness is the least of the epithets they used on our hero. Its hero, admittedly, is not all that wonderful. Hamilton was a trailblazer, and he had guts. Like Jack Johnson a couple of generations later, he was a black champion who never wasted a second trying to placate the white folks who he knew detested him. But he never pretended to be a champion of his people. He had no interest in abolition or other social causes, and those who did, people like Frederick Douglass and James McKeown Smith, they knew Hamilton quite well and actually held him up as a kind of negative role model. In fact, Haswell pretty much got it right. Hamilton comes across as a good bit of a scoundrel and a double dealer, though probably no worse than most of his white colleagues. But he also was brilliant and shrewd, and he seems to have been just about the only business rival who ever won the respect of Cornelius Vanderbilt, who despised everybody. He also belonged to the New York Society Library. I would love to be able to mention the Charles Haswell for cutting the ice again. But this book isn't just about Hamilton. It's also about the New York where he and other black people were struggling to deal with a rising tide of segregation that followed the end of slavery here. A city where race relations were deteriorating rapidly in the run-up to the Civil War, and where a black skin literally could get you snatched off the street and sold into slavery. We also get to meet some heroic African-Americans from that era. We all know about Rosa Parks and what she did in 1955. Shane White introduces us to Elizabeth Jennings, a school teacher who refused to let an Irish conductor put her off a Third Avenue streetcar in 1854. And Thomas Downing, who ran an oyster saloon near Wall Street, once told a judge that he wasn't obliged to answer questions in court since the Dred Scott case had made it clear that he didn't have any rights there. Unfortunately, Shane White isn't here to receive this award, though he sends his thanks. His excuse is that he lives in Sydney, Australia. Which raises an interesting final thought. Why are we getting African-American history from a white writer who lives 10,000 miles from Harlem? The obvious answer is he's made it his business to study the subject. And in fact, this is his sixth book on African-American studies. He says on his website that he's been at the University of Sydney since he was 17 years old, but it seemed clear his heart is in Harlem. It may also be that precisely because he's not an American, and his vantage point is literally half a world away, that this material struck him with particular force and freshness, qualities that happily found their way into his narrative. So, for opening new windows onto the city's past, and for casting new and provocative light on what we thought was a familiar era in our history, I'm happy to say that we're going to be sending a New York City Book Award to Shane White.
Crosshatch of straight lines with no third dimension suggesting either the varied natural topography or how structures might rise from it and give it texture and shape. So writes Gerard Capel. At some undetermined time, he goes on, enough of it would be built for people to begin to see a grid and understand that it would not stop until they had conquered Manhattan. The author's book, City on a Grid, How New York Became New York, reveals how the borough's layout of rectangular blocks and boulevards affected our town's destiny. Ordained in 1811 by three eminent commissioners, Simeon DeWitt, Governor Morris, and John Rutherford, the grid plan had decisive consequences. It shaped development, sparked real estate speculation, and transformed city government from landowner to realty tax collector. The grid also gave birth to a municipal bureaucracy, making underground connections with the Croton Reservoir system required civil servants to protect the orderly street network above. Government's acquisition of private property to keep the grid marching north yielded constitutional principles for takings of land. And the grid's imposition leveled or rounded off most of Manhattan's hills, creating a borough with fewer peaks and valleys, bringing New Yorkers together literally on more equal footing. Yet another manifestation of the city's growing middle class. With historical precision and a stylish, absorbing narrative, the author puts the grid center stage in several fascinating episodes, railroads seeking rights of way through the heart of Manhattan, for example, and campaigns for more curved streets, diagonal avenues. Inevitably, he cites some strong opinions about the grid from acute, demanding observers. Henry James, Frederick Law Olmsted, Thomas Edison, Louis Mumford, Edmund Wilson, and Jean-Paul Sartre are among those who weigh in. By showing us how Manhattan's streetscape came to be and how it might have turned out otherwise, City on a Grid makes us see so much more about New York with greater clarity, earning its author, Gerard Tappell, our commendation.
Thanks also to my devoted and patient agent, Russ Galen. I threw Russ a bunch of pitches for this book that before he liked my stuff well enough to show it to editors. Bob Pigeon, classical scholar, scrupulous and inspired editor, who took my Erie Canal book from Russ, snapped up Grid quickly. Thanks, Bob. We're doing more books together, we hope. Thanks also to Da Capo publicity head and human dynamo, Lissa Warren, who's home near Boston at this hour, working her Twitter, cranked on cranberry and seltzer. My wife, a former publicist herself, of course, not only read and commented on much that went into this book, vetting my shower inspirations and late night imaginings, but also approved grudgingly at times how great a job Lissa had done and was doing. And finally, Da Capo marketing maven Sean Mayer, who nurtured me into the Twitter sphere. I did dawdle for a bit until the book was actually published, and I can now claim 96 followers. at Copel G. The great thing about writing history is that people you write about are generally in no position to raise objections. And when you write the first narrative history of a particular thing, even the living don't have much on which to base objections. City on a Grid takes a decidedly different position from the one staked out several years ago by a popular and quite brilliant bicentennial exhibit on the grid at the Museum of the City of New York, and the excellent and beautifully produced companion catalog, to which I contributed, that followed it. The greatest grid, says the exhibit and the catalog. Superlatives, though, always worry me a little bit. I imagined a Stephen Colbert satirical proposition. Manhattan Street Plan. Great grid? Greatest grid. Remember? As my own research into its origins and effects started suggesting something less than greatness, and possibly not even goodness, I wondered about that daunting superlative, Greatest Grid. I knew that it was the title of a fine scholarly essay by urban history professor Edward Spann, The Greatest Grid, the New York Plan of 1811, published in 1988, that essay marked, as best I can tell, the first time our grid was declared the greatest. I read this essay a number of years ago, and now I went back to it looking for that telltale phrase and what Spann had to say about it. But it's not there. That alliterative couplet, greatest grid, is not in Spann's text. He never called our grid the greatest, nor did he set about defending or explaining how or why it supposedly was. The phrase, greatest grid, it turns out, appears only in the title of the essay, which was published in a book of numerous essays on urban topics. Was greatest grid nothing more than Spann's, or perhaps his editor's, snappy title slapped on an essay that made no actual argument for the grid's greatness? Professor Spann died in 2004, and I have not yet tracked down his editor. But I feel pretty confident that I've disturbed no grave by taking the greatness out of the grid. Instead, I wrote a book about a thing that readers can evaluate for themselves. The creation of the grid turns out to have been modest at best. The creators more unfocused than inspired. And its users have had a seriously congested life ever since. It is then simply the plan we've got. The first and only street plan for the bulk of Manhattan Island until and if we choose or need to make another. Until then, we might as well celebrate its remarkable linear right angular power, query what could have been, and conjure what might come next. I once wrote in a book review of Unearthing Gotham, a winner here 14 years ago, that New York is a city that eats its history. In the intervening years, the appetite has been suppressed a bit on the ground, but developers have simply adjusted their feeding habits to space with less evident history and looser boundaries, the air, where the newest generation of buildings, many of them empty condo stacks, are now reaching recently unimaginable heights. As Adam Gopnik wrote in The New Yorker, as he archly classified these buildings in The New Yorker, quote, oligarchs' erections. It's in the October 5th issue. Still, whether venerable four-story brownstone or speculative sky cloud scraper, practically every Manhattan building is alike in one essential way. Short or tall, squat or skinny, it emerges from a rectangular ground lot. All the creatures of the grid. Boston, which never got a regular street plan, was supposed to be the recreation of the biblical city on a hill. Manhattan, literally the Lenape Island of hills, is for two centuries now and counting, and for better or worse, the city on a grid. Thanks very much.
Sure to perform his duties with precision and dedication. The author argues Arthur Brown skillfully interweaves Battle's story with a lively cultural history of the Harlem Renaissance, as well as many traumatic events of the 20th century, such as the race riots and the world wars. We learn of events that mirror the continuing fraying of race relations in our own time, such as riots set off by true or false rumors of police brutality and the mistreatment of wrongly accused black defendants. Brown also describes how Battle's career intersected with an amazing array of better-known historical figures, such as the champion boxer Joe Louis, the Olympic runner Jesse Owens, and the tap dancer Bojangles Robinson. After years of being snubbed by most of the police force and the police brass, Battle finally found political protectors in Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, who protected him, unfortunately, intermittently. But First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt was a steadfast supporter, and she even wrote an impassioned introduction to the biography of Samuel Battle that Langston Hughes wrote, but this was never published. Brown's book includes lengthy excerpts from Hughes' unpublished manuscript that was based on interviews of Hughes with Battle himself. So we are lucky that Mr. Brown resurrected this impressive story and expanded this narrative and quotes from it in great detail about this pioneer who might otherwise have been lost to history. So I wanted to just finish by reading an excerpt of Eleanor Roosevelt's introduction to Langston Hughes' book, which never got published and which serves as an introduction to this book. She says, "This is a record of a man's life, and as he tells it, you not only see one life, but you see the struggles and the victories and the defeats of a whole group of U.S. citizens. What courage it took, what remarkable stamina to be the first colored policeman in New York City. There were qualities of mind and heart and body that were purely personal, but above everything else, there was the realization that he was fighting not for himself, but for his people. That comes out in the pride when each first is won." And then she ends by saying, "Congratulations on a life well lived." And she really became a personal friend of his. So I'd like to present this award to Arthur Brown.
Samuel Battle was a great man and a great African-American. He was also a great man and a great African-American who was erased from history. He was cast into oblivion by white society along with so many other African-Americans. Samuel Jesse Battle was the son of former slaves. He was born in 1883 in New Bern, North Carolina. He was 16.5 pounds at birth. And he would later say, "As a result, I guess I've always wanted to be large, and I have been large." In fact, later in life, his size, 6 foot two and 240 pounds, would be crucial to his success as a cop. Sam Battle loved his mother. For all his life, no son could love a mother more. She tended to the sprawling family, singing hymns as she hung the laundry. Sam Battle's father was a brick mason who had bought freedom, no small feat. His father was also a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, and he instilled Christianity deeply in his son. As much as Battle relied on his physical power, he would draw even more strength from his faith. And so I found it fitting to draw the title of One Righteous Man from Psalm 106. Blessed are they who observe justice, who do righteousness at all times. With only an eighth grade education, Battle became New York City's first American cop in 1911, first black sergeant in 1926, first black lieutenant in 1935, and in 1941, New York City's first black parole commissioner, filling a seat that had been held by Lou Gehrig. Battle also became an aide to Mayor LaGuardia and friend to First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. Now, how do I know the intimate things that I know about Samuel Battle? How do I know his thoughts and his feelings? How do I know about the amazing cast of characters he met in life and about his terrible trials and great forgotten triumphs? I know because Samuel Battle wanted his story told. So we hired Langston Hughes, the genius poet of the Harlem Renaissance, to write his biography in 1949. And Langston Hughes did that. Together, Battle and Hughes produced an 80,000-word manuscript. Publishers rejected it out of hand. Why? Remember the question, why? The manuscript produced by Samuel Battle and Langston Hughes gathered dust for six decades until it was my great good fortune to discover its existence. The document revealed Battle to be a man with a huge magnetic personality, and as a man who had engaged throughout his entire adult life with major African-American artists, writers, athletes, professionals, politicians, clergy, and gangsters. Thus, his remarkable personal saga enabled me, I hope, to illuminate the important events of New York City African-American history from 1900 to 1950, with African-Americans in the foreground, not in the background, and not on the sidelines. What made Sam Battle successful? First, he never knew slavery. Born into the first post-slavery generation, he felt freer to be a boy, not a boy. He insisted on being treated with dignity, and I'll illustrate with an episode from Battle's young teen years, as rendered by Hughes in Battle's own words. I passed the home of a prominent white family, the Bryans. On the sidewalk, one of the Bryan boys was playing with marbles with others, so I stopped. I was about sure that I could beat any of them, and I said, I'd like to shoot marbles. I bet I could beat any of you playing. I stooped down to play, and they said to me, and now pardon me, I am going to use the most terrible of words because this is the truth of how Battle and Hughes told the story, and I will not flinch from it. We don't want no niggers here, Mr. Bryan's son said that. As he did, I slapped him with my right hand on the side of his face. The boy screamed because I had a powerful hand. I was a big, strong, husky fellow. His mother ran out. His mother said, what is your name, boy? We'll have you arrested. I said, my name is John Brown. And Sam Battle didn't know who John Brown was. And I walked away. It did not take them long to discover that it was Tom Battle's son who had wanted to fight young Brian. Since my father was well known to the white people of the town, the warrant was promptly withdrawn. Instead, we went to the Bryan's back door. Young Brian still bore the marks of my hand. When my father saw the youngster's face and learned what I had done, I had struck a white boy. My father offered to let Mr. Brian or his son whip me. Before either of them could answer, I said to my father, I will die first. I will let you whip me, but not anyone else on earth. No one said a word, so I repeated, you can whip me, but nobody else. Seeing that I meant what I said, my father whipped me. I was flogged severely there in the yard. This the white family accepted as satisfactory. I took my father's punishment and did not shed a tear. Nothing in the world could have made me cry. Sam Battle struck out from New Bern on his own at the age of 16 at the opening of the 20th century. Well before the start of the Great Migration, he headed north because he felt the North offered greater opportunities. two of his mother's cousins lived in Brooklyn, where they operated a horse-drawn trucking business. They visited New Bern and became bright, shining figures to young Battle. He told Hughes, "When I first saw those wonderful relatives of my mother's, I began to long for the day when I might go north to call on them and to live as they did." His travels eventually brought Battle to New York City for opportunities for African Americans in the turn of the 20th century were extremely limited. He worked as a houseboy for wealthy white New Yorkers, while also entering a vibrant black society that was centered on West 53rd Street. As he went throughout his life, he engaged there with leading African-American writers, entertainers, sports figures, and the like. Among those he met was Arthur Schomburg, the great bibliophile who preserved African-American literature. Schomburg advised young Battle to read, read, and read some more. Battle did as Schomburg instructed. Highly intelligent, another key to Battle's success. He became a remarkably self-educated man. Battle took a step up the ladder by taking a job as a red cap at the old Grand Central Depot. And he got to know the men and luminaries who passed through the station. Twice he carried a bag with Jack Johnson, the black heavyweight boxing champion, who had stunned and outraged white America by winning the crown. He learned about Italian food from Enrico Caruso, had a bit part in a Broadway musical, and greeted Teddy Roosevelt, a man he adored, for hosting Booker T. Washington at dinner in the White House. After 6 years as a red cap, Battle set his mind on breaking the police department's color line. Looking back, he cast the decision merely as one of economics. Married and the father of a young son, he saw no future in toting luggage. But there was likely more to it than financial security. This was around 1910. The NAACP was being founded, and Battle became a life member. There were calls for African Americans to take the police civil service test, and Battle began the fight of his life. When the test school denied him entry, Battle studied on his own. After he aced the exam, the police surgeon claimed Battle had a heart murmur. Battle got a white physician, and it had to be a white physician, to certify to his health. When finally the police commissioner had no choice but to appoint Battle, cops subjected him to 2 years of silence. Someone left a note with a bullet hole, warning him to quit. They sent a white woman to entrap Battle into a sexual liaison, knowing that a black man caught in such a relationship was doomed. They put him on display on the street like a carnival act. Tour buses brought gawkers to stare at the colored cop. And they made him sleep apart. This was before 911 and before cars. Cops slept in station house dormitories to be on emergency reserve. Battle's fellow officers moved his bed to a room where they stored the American flag. Here's how he remembered the experience. "Sometimes lying on my cot in the silence, I would wonder how it was that many of the patrolmen in my precinct, who did not yet speak English well, had no such difficulties in getting on the force's eye, a Negro-American experience. Native-born and foreign-born whites on the police force united in looking past me, as though I were not a human being. In the law, in the dark, with the stars and stripes, I wondered why." At that, Battle was embarked on a three-decade fight to overcome, to prove that he was not only equal to white cops, but that he was better than they were. He studied for the sergeant's exam in the flag law, telling himself that these men would not speak with him today as an equal, would answer to him tomorrow as a superior. Eventually, he rose. He plunged into the swirling corruption of the roaring 20s and was banished to Canarsie by a corrupt police commissioner. He built a mutually beneficial, if sometimes cynical, relationship with the Guardia, who held Battle up to black New Yorkers as a personification of mayoral good faith, while Battle took full advantage of his position as an African-American symbol. Never was he more useful to LaGuardia than during Black Friday in 1935 and 1943. Meanwhile, Battle thrilled to the rise of Harlem during the Renaissance and watched the evolution of the ghetto and the devastation of the Depression. He made sensational arrests, and he headed the New York NYPD's first SWAT team. He guided an equally tough and smart protege through an even tougher fight to integrate the fire department. He mentored young Sugar Ray Robinson. He suffered the joys and pains of being a hero to many African Americans, and at times being seen as part of a corrupt, racist police force by many others. When the race was run, when Battle was retired and passing lazy afternoons with Jackie Robinson, he hired you as Baltimore. Publishers were not interested. Why? Another good question, why? 6 years later, Samuel Battle fell ill with leukemia. By then, the NYPD had 1,200 African-American cops. He summoned to his bedside 5 nephews. His last words to them were, "The torch has been passed." Ever optimistic, he expected progress. Quote, "Not just for the Negro's sake, but for the sake of my country, I look forward to the day when all of us would do unto others as we would have others do unto us," he wrote to close his book. On August 7, 1966, Samuel Jesse Battle died at the age of 83, a man who had bent the long moral arc as far as he could, and then was erased from memory. So why did publishers reject his own death? In truth, Hughes was not particularly interested in the project. The narrative was not particularly compelling. But editors could have made it compelling. None chose to. And the reason, I believe, is clear. Racism. Because for most of U.S. history, until the Civil Rights Movement, mainstream publishers wanted nothing to do with African-American life stories. After publication of One Righteous Man, I explored the industry's record of producing African-American biographies. My discoveries were appalling. It was not until 1968 that the celebrated firm of Simon & Schuster produced its first African-American biography. And it was only the children's book about Harriet Tubman. Across 7 decades, the count for Randa House was just 5 books. Behold Reinhardt and Winston, 3 books. And for Scribner's, merely 2. Every mainstream publisher was equally guilty. During the half century from 1900 to 1950, they offered a total of just 48 black life stories, an average of less than 1 a year, with no new books in 22 of the 50 years. Meanwhile, behind a virtually impenetrable barrier, African Americans ached to have their stories told. As happened to Samuel Battle, so many were erased from history, the saintly and the sinners, because white Americans were hostile to African-American life stories that necessarily indicted white racism. But those black lives didn't matter. Think just of the young readers who learn about the world through bookstores, books, who aspire to be role models. Black and white, they had infinitesimal access to books about African-American sports heroes, entertainers, or adventurers. And forget about civil rights crusaders. You heard about Elizabeth Jennings. She made history in New York in 1854, just like Rosa Parks did. No one published a biography. In 1892, William Lewis became the first black college football All-American and went on to become a great lawyer. President Taft appointed him to a post beside the United States Attorney General. No one published his biography. The losses to readers, black and white, to black history and to the history of the United States States of America are both shameful and immeasurable. And I'm only happy to have been able, I hope, to fulfill the goals and the hopes of life's news at Samuel Hutton. Thank you very much. Scholarship, reading publics is sharply focused and thoroughly researched. It's also engagingly written and provides ample historical context for the general reader. But the book does much more. As the title suggests, this is a book about people and about ideas, about the body politic and the role of libraries in American society. Because libraries provide an essential service, Lynn shows, the story of their evolution and of the changing constituencies they serve is inseparable from the larger question of what constitutes the common good and who should define it. Beginning in the mid-18th century with the founding of the New York Society Library, and continuing through the 19th century, Lynn tells the stories of the New York Historical Society, the Mercantile Library, and other subscription libraries and research libraries, along with the New York's various free circulating libraries and the modern library movement, culminating with the establishment of the New York Public Library in 1895. Examining the contemporary debates over who should have access to the libraries and what is proper for them to read, Glynn's book is a poignant and profound exploration of what is lost and what is gained as New York City grows from a colonial seaport town into a colossus of industrial capitalism. Through the stories of the libraries, we see the communal values of the early republic clash with economic liberalism, individualism. Intimate associations give way to anonymity, commercialism. But I'm happy to report, and I don't think I'll spoil anything by telling you that the book has a happy ending. Ultimately, in the complex and contested merger the Astor, Lennox, and Tilden Foundations to create the New York Public Library, unvarnished greed is overcome by an expansive vision of the common good of a democratic society. For anyone who loves books and loves New York City, reading publics is an essential piece of our education. So please join me in congratulating Tom.
I'd like to thank everyone who I worked with at Fordham University Press. They were extremely generous, especially in regards to the illustrations in my book. All of my notes were included, my complete bibliography. Academic presses are sort of are getting stingier and stingier in that respect. I was very honored that they included everything. More generally, the Empire State Edition, which is in print at Fordham University Press, aims to make scholarship on New York accessible to the general reading public. I think that's very commendable, and I was very honored that they published my book. Secondly, I'd like to thank the Society Library. Much of the research for my book was done here in this building, and everyone I worked with was incredibly generous with their time and their resources. I'm very grateful for that. The library is a private organization, but it's recently played a very valuable public role in advancing scholarship, especially in print culture and library history. As someone who studies not just the history of reading and the history of libraries, but on public institutions and how we define the public good. I greatly appreciate that. And finally, I'd like to thank the awards committee. I'm very deeply honored to receive the Horn Border Award. Famous editor took Roger to lunch to courting his approval, and according to sources who were in the Royalton at that time, neither spoke for an hour and a half. This came to be known as the silent lunch. Forget about the silent lunch. He took me once to the coffee house, this adorable little club on 45th Street, and he taught. I'm sure I talked more because I was 28 years old. I signed myself with anxiety. So it's not me who's made up this iconic figure idea, although you are one. But Bobby Lee, who was on the committee, was saying one day during my deliberation, we should give an award to Vivian. She's an iconic figure. I know I can't. I know you. I am a pain in the rear. Anyway, if I can turn to my remarks. You have really been a voice in our heads for so long. It's not just being a writer, it's not just being a memoirist or an essayist or a writer of nonfiction. You write about, you, in a sense, are a metonymy for New York. I should note that both of you, John Updike, you remember that he said people who lived in New York felt that everyone who didn't live in New York was kidding. I mean, I'm sure the two of you feel this way. Vivian has mostly written about New York, though she did write a book about going to Egypt in search of some guy. And Roger will go down to spring training once in a while. But otherwise, it's really New York. And when we think of these kind of quintessential experiences of New York, Jewish immigrant families on the Lower East Side, or feminist criticism, or biographies of post-war women in American history, or life in Greenwich Village in the 20s or 30s or every other decade since, she is the one that we really think of. One of her books that troubled me a little is The Men in My Life, in which she vigorously attacks Saul Bellow and Bill Roth and other
like male writers, mostly Jewish, but I'm sure I'm not objective about this, and you're entitled to your opinion. All the other 24 books are fantastic. And also, I don't know how to go on too long. What now?
What
did I say now? When I'm always aware of you when I walk around New York because you're so geographically precise. You're always on 40th Street and 6th Avenue, or on 50th Street and 8th Avenue, or in Washington Square Park. It's like you're just there, ubiquitous. I had a lover's quarrel with the world. That's from Robert Frost. Vivian has a lover's quarrel with her mother, and which she wrote about at great length in Fierce Attachments, which I believe is from 1970, a long time ago, and it's being reprinted now. But in any event, it's a fantastic book, which I've just read for the second time, and Vivian and her mother bicker endlessly about everything and about nothing, and have tedious agreements and disagreements in coffee shops. But then this moment happens. Her cheeks flush and her pudding soft face hardens wonderfully with new definition. She looks beautiful to me. I know from experience she will remember this afternoon as a deeply pleasurable one. I also know that she will not be able to tell anyone why it has been pleasurable. She enjoys thinking, only she doesn't know it. I find this incredibly touching because it's very tart and unsentimental and tough and obviously furious of her mother, but also very loving and able to bring out this quality of affection in her mother. And in another place you say, whenever she said anything really interesting, she would sort of glow, and obviously paraphrasing, you would write it so much better. But that's what really appeals to me so much about your work. So many things appeal to me. But if that you have this your unfettered, is this a euphemism? Your uncensored, your unfettered, so let me look at my words for them. You're unfettered by self-censorship, yet under the surveillance of self-discipline. So my own life has been made richer by your presence, your work, and by knowing you, and you have made me think, even if I don't know that that's what I'm doing. So, what do I do with this?
Give it to me. Work it out.
Work it out.
Tom Glenn's book, which I am thrilled that a book on the public libraries in New York has been written, because one of the seminal experiences in my own life was growing up in the Bronx in a working class immigrant neighborhood. We had everything we needed on a single street, right? The grocer, the butcher, the drugstore, the doctor. And we also had the bank, and we had a library. The library was a New York public library, storefront library on this street. When I was 8 years old, my mother walked me to the library. We walked in, it was a storefront, completely surrounded by books, floor to ceiling. And in the middle was a desk, the room was a desk. And sitting at the desk was Edith Wharton or Eleanor Roosevelt, take your pick. A woman who looked like that, with velvet puffed hair, gray, big bosom, steel rimmed glasses. My mother marched me up to her. She pointed at my head and she said, She loves to read. And Eleanor Roosevelt said to me, come. She took me to the front of the store, to the library, and on the left-hand side, and this was the children's section, and she said, start here. And I went around that whole store, that whole library, until I went to City College. So that is New York. I can't tell you how much that is New York to me. Many, many years later, a few years ago, actually, when the city section of the New York Times still existed, I wrote a story on the branch libraries. I went to 17 branch libraries in the Bronx and Manhattan. I especially loved the children's book libraries, who were all dedicated, really dedicated, and gave me another view of the neighborhoods of New York. One young woman especially who said passionately, you never know where the readers are. They can be in the great neighborhoods and the terrible neighborhoods, you never know. And then the librarian down at Chatham Square in Chinatown, she said to me, once a woman came in very late, Chinese, an immigrant. She walked in the door and looked at this great library, and she turned to the librarian and she said, free? Free? So I recovered my sense of New York as a child. Essentially, that story I just told you is how I've experienced the city my entire life. And what this book is about is me on the ground, on the street. I've never experienced New York in any other way. I experienced it as eye level. There was an English writer named Storm Jameson, a woman who grew up in Yorkshire in the middle of the late 19th century, in a windy, windswept, small town on the upper northern coast of England. And she became a writer. She came down to London. She, in the course of her life, wrote 45 novels, became a passionate traveler, and what she loved above all were the cities of the world. And out of that beginning, never stopping hungry for the world, she traveled everywhere. And it was only in New York City that she said, what I coined, that she saw the world at eye level. It was only in New York that she wasn't preoccupied with architecture or even with public spaces, but the incredible feel of the crowds on the street. Now that is exactly how I've experienced New York my entire life. For me, it's just the stories. And the stories in this book, The Odd Woman in the City, have really, really began about 30 years ago. I've been writing little bits and pieces all my life, and going home and never knowing what to do with them. Many years ago, I thought I had it. I thought I had a structure for it. I was going to put down on the street a middle-aged, divorced feminist walking the streets of a great city. But somehow, I didn't know that woman well enough to make a narrative that went somewhere. And it was only years later, in the last few years, and it was only really through the good offices of two women who are in this room tonight, my editor Eileen Smith of Farrar Straus and my agent Charlotte Sheedy, because of those two women, this book got written, and I thank you very much.
Now this is an august ceremony for
one of our two icons. But I hope you won't mind if I tell the joke. I read it in the book upstairs, three floors up, and I just began cackling away. And maybe later, I guess it was Theo, probably, who said, "What were you laughing about?" So this is what I laughed about. Again, not my doing, my teacher, good morning, class. This is the first day of school, and we're going to introduce ourselves. I'll call on you one by one, and you can tell us your name and maybe what your dad. Maybe what your dad or mom does for a living. You please, over at the center, small boys. My name is Irving and my dad is a mechanic. Teacher, a mechanic, thank you, Irving. Next, small girl. My name is Emma, my mom is a lawyer. Teacher, how nice for you, Emma. Next, second small boy. My name is Luke and my dad is dead. Oh, that's sad, Luke. Could you tell us what your dad did before he died? Remember, this is in the book. This isn't like some friar's roast. Luke, we're so very sad. Do you think you could tell us what your dad did before he died? Luke seizes his throat. He went, oh! Now we can get to the heart of the matter. Roger can't write a bad sentence, a bad paragraph, a bad essay, a bad letter. All of these things are in this old man, sometimes these lazy compendia that people just throw together from what's in their drawer. I've read this book twice. I look every word in this book. Even this memo, inner office memo to David Remnick, he puts in the book, which I also I'm a lifelong R. Crumb devotee, and while I do admire our scheduled Genesis chapter from this forthcoming version of the book, I fear that Seven Spreads is going to put us way over our pubic hair allowance in 2009. So, one waits for everything he writes. I'm sure that for your whole life, you've been waiting for Christmas to read Greetings, Friend, right? Greetings, Friend, with those wonderful couplets. Now, Sister Wendy, come with me, and we'll go sit on Santa's knee. And then there are the talk pieces and the profiles, and my favorites of all the favorites of your genres in which you write are the baseball pieces, which I'm not a particular fan of baseball and haven't been since I left Chicago, where the Cubs never won, but I know you would be sympathetic to them because you're more sympathetic figure. You write, no matter what you're writing about baseball, it could be a game in 1958 or 2008. And I don't know the team, and I don't know the names of the players, I don't know anything. When I read, I've just plucked one out of the thousand. The patterns of the game became clear when the veteran Cardinals starter, Adam Wainwright, could only smile wanly after allowing a feeble pop by Stephen Drew to drop like a thrombosed dove. Like a thrombosed dove. Can you believe that? Anyway, it's great to have you here in the sense, in the old sense, Roger. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I want to really congratulate all of you. winners of the awards here. Each one of you, you are authors, and I'm a writer. And there's a real difference. One of my books is an actual book from front to back, and the rest of it are faced up jobs. Seriously. And I'm in awe of all of you, and thank you so much. I also want to thank the Onik family for helping so much, particularly Mr. Ike Onik. Hearing a lot about labor from him, Ike Onik. Jim made a reference to a dinner at the Royals, a lunch at the Royals between me and a famous publisher. It wasn't a famous publisher, it was our new editor, Tina Brown. She just arrived. And I'd been to New York forever, and she thought that she should take me to her regular lunch place, and we could see it together, and we could chat. And what you don't know about me is that I'm a little shy, first of all, I have no small talk. And Tina's full of small talk, but didn't know anything about baseball. not much about the New Yorker, so that was that silence. So there was another thing I could see him looking at him. I couldn't figure out who was sticking who. We got along great after that. I will always be grateful to Tina because she convinced me, against my better judgment, to begin writing about more personal things, about my family. Pushed me, and I've done a lot of it a little more recently, and I'm getting her debt. And I'm also in the debt of every single New Yorker editor thread with Howard Ross. I want to pause here because Robin Frank, in her wonderful opening remarks, the slight indication that people like us would not know much about Coney Island. I grew up exactly 14 blocks north of here. And sort of a privileged part of town, but I knew all about Coney Island. I went there all the time. My parents took me there, and I took myself there as often as possible. I became an expert on every ride at Coney Island, and including the dopey steeplechase horses. I found the Cyclone was the best. I also knew about the fun house there, where you would watch and later take a girlfriend with you and walk across the place. I knew where all these events were, the things that they were coming, their skirts were broken. And I also remember vividly as a New Yorker, I think in the 1940s, when a key witness in the Murder Incorporated trial was thrown out of a window of the Half Moon Hotel at Coney Island. And the front page of the Mirror and also the news had one of those thick arrows like this, painted in arrows, but now with a point like this on the back, and the kid twist relis that he's thrown out the window, so he could not testify. So I'm a real New Yorker anyway. I think that's all, but thank you very much. I love libraries in New York, and I love New York, and I'm very honored to be here. Thank you.
Anyway, so I'm going to come in. I won't be able to speak. Maybe it's a good thing.